We have a half hour plus. So what I'd ask you to do is raise your hand so I can see them. Keep them up for a while so I can constitute a list. And please, when you first speak, say who you are.
Steve Wall, and I'm going to ask Peter.
Do you want to speak to the mic? Are people hearing on the other side?
No, not that you're
raising the mic.
C'est ça, il faut tendre le micro devant pour avoir le micro.
There's a thing that says bike.
Okay, I got that. That's better. Okay, so Peter, it was unclear to me that the principle of legislative neutrality that you think is valid actually has the anti-perfectionist implications that you draw toward the end of the paper. And here's why I think that. The principle that you defend makes crucial reference to the idea of an important liberty, right? So the idea is that if you're dealing with an important liberty, then you couldn't justify restricting it by reference to a non-neutral reason or one of the reasons on your list. So a kind of first thought is, in determining what counts as an important liberty, right, you might need to refer to perfectionist theory of the good, or at least that's one way of doing it, right? So you might be happy with that. That might be consistent with accepting the principle. But there's going to have to be some distinction here between important and non-important liberties. Okay, so then when we get to the part at the end, it seems like you're assuming that governments can't prohibit activities on the grounds that they're base or shameful or don't fully develop human capacities and so forth there. And that wouldn't follow, right, unless we were dealing here with an important liberty. And I thought some of the examples you gave didn't seem like good cases of important liberties, like whether prostitution will be on the list of the important liberties or whether just the liberty to take hard drugs would be on the list. So it seemed like, at best, you get a kind of much weaker anti-perfectionist conclusion from the principle.
Yeah, good question. I didn't define the notion of an important liberty. And I mean, it's a potentially fairly elastic notion. And I think there's been considerable ambivalence ever since Mill about what the scope of liberty is that the relevant principles are supposed to cover. So even Mill, he sort of limits the application of the harm principle to freedom of thought and opinion, liberty of tastes and pursuits, and freedom of combination. Well, what exactly does that leave out? It's not exactly clear, but there's some sort of idea that the principle is supposed to apply it's not supposed to sort of apply to every possible question that could come up, say, having to do with maybe traffic control and so forth and so on. So you're asking me, I guess, what do I take the scope, legislative neutrality or anti-perfectionism to be? And I have to say that I'm not totally decided about this. What I mean by an important liberty, though, is probably broader than what some people, fundamental or basic liberties. I mean any liberty that the limitation of which really imposes a significant burden on someone. So I actually think drug laws and prostitution laws do impose significant burdens on people. And so they would actually count as that is, it's not a trivial limitation of someone's liberty to threaten them with penalties for selling or purchasing sex. I mean, that's a fairly significant encroachment. So I actually would say that the anti-perfectionism would go that far. Would it include everything that we would want to count of as a liberty? Well, I'm not sure about that.
Yes,
sorry.
So it's also a question for Peter. Two quick questions. One is that, I mean, when you're focusing on limitations of liberty, many people would have thought that the neutrality principle is supposed to oppose not just restrictions of liberty that are not, but cajoling and other kinds of acts. I mean, suppose the state, just suppose it isn't prohibiting people from doing things or restricting their liberty, it's actively proselytizing for atheism, or it's actively proselytizing for that same-sex sex is good, you know, being things that I'm probably in favor of. But we do this in a cajoling way rather than a prohibiting way. Are you just neutral on that? I mean, that's one question. The second question is about, you describe the neutrality principle as the inherent, as the revision of Mill's harm principle. I wonder then about, is it a policy or is it a principle? I mean, for Mill, the no paternalism is pretty clearly a policy. It's not a fundamental principle. The fundamental principle is utilitarianism, what makes people better off in the long run. And then he thinks that in the conditions of modern society, it will be a good practical guideline. That doesn't have any theoretical status, but it's just a good seat-of-the-pants hunch. And maybe he feels very strongly about it, but it's really just a hunch, and you could just show him some facts and make it move. But the neutrality principle, I mean, does it have that? I thought of it as having a more fundamental status, as you're describing it. So how do you see the neutrality principle as sort of the level of fundamental principle, or like Mill's harm principle, kind of derived from something more?
I see it as like Mill's harm principle is derived from something. So I think some people have taken it as a fundamental principle or something closer to a fundamental principle, but when I look at Dworkin, I see the fundamental principle as being equality of concern and respect, and then neutrality was supposed to be proposed as a kind of interpretation of that, but it wasn't exactly clear how that worked. But if you look at the way I conceive of it, I sort of say, well, I start within a broadly contractualist framework, and I would think that the neutrality principle would be one of those principles that couldn't be reasonably rejected, and so it's a valid principle, but it's not the most fundamental principle. And the question of cajoling, I guess I would say as I suggested in my earlier response to Daniel, I think the primary concern has to do with limitations of liberty, and that's the most important issue, and that's where the idea of neutrality, I think, is most defensible and makes the most sense. But I also think that, of course, that there could be related objections to certain kinds of cajoling. And so, for example, I think the school prayer issue could be seen as an object. I mean, the mandatory school prayer could be seen as a kind of objectionable cajoling. Okay, you're not forced to pray if you don't want, but nonetheless, being in an environment where everyone's expected to pray imposes a certain burden on somebody. So under certain conditions, I think that cajoling can be sufficiently burdensome that although it doesn't constitute a limitation of liberty, it still raises the sorts of concerns where we have to ask, are these non-neutral reasons an adequate justification for imposing that sort of burden on individuals? In the case of school prayer, for example, I don't think it would be an adequate justification.
I should invite, to avoid the sort of excessively press conference type discussion which these setups almost invariably lead to, I should invite anybody to feel free to say something about any question. Having said that, I'll move on to the next question. I don't know you.
Yeah. Ian Carroll. I'm an assistant to Professor Martin.
We're actually recording the proceedings, so right. It might make it easier.
Daniel, you should put your mic on.
That's true.
It's on.
Oh, okay.
It struck me that it would be quite surprising if a single theory of neutrality did track our intuitions about what neutrality represents perfectly. And it seemed to me that the list of things you set out could be unified to a large extent. And 10 out of 12, I thought, could be thought of as they seem to involve the state asserting the falsehood of some conception of the good or of value, and the exceptions possibly and partially being the second item and the ninth item on your list. So the kind of example you use to refute the unifying conception is the democratic state prohibiting homosexual sex because the majority disapproves. The reason the state has for prohibiting homosexual sex on this account is that the majority has voted in favor of prohibition, so that's a neutral reason step back, however, and ask what reason the majority has for supporting prohibition. The problem seems to be different. The one thing that certainly can't count as a reason for the majority, a reason neutral or otherwise for the majority to support the prohibition, is the fact that the majority support the prohibition. So the procedural reason, the neutral procedural reason is available, and the majority's proposal seems to be unsupported by a neutral reason.
Dick Arneson asked me about this in the break, and what I was talking about in talking about the majority disapproval, I didn't actually mean to be referring to a procedural reason. I meant to be referring to the fact that the majority disapproves. Okay, so in Lawrence versus Texas, Justice Scalia suggests that the fact that the majority disapproves of homosexuality is a rational basis for state laws that prohibit it, okay? So what I'm suggesting is you can look at the fact of majority disapproval as itself a reason. That's not a procedural reason, that's a sort of social fact that constitutes a reason for the legislators to propose and vote for the legislation. Now, I think that when Dworkin first proposed the idea of neutrality as being essential to liberalism, this was a quintessentially non-neutral reason for him. And I think if you look at his work throughout the 70s and the 80s, the idea that the government can prohibit a form of conduct simply because the majority disapproves morally or in some other way is a reason that's supposed to be ruled out. So I agree that you have an easier time of finding a unified account of neutral reasons if you didn't count that as a non-neutral reason, but you'd be losing an important aspect of the principle of neutrality as it was originally proposed, and it wouldn't do the work that the people who originally defended it thought it would do.
Just, I guess, suppose I'm an undecided member of the public, deciding how to vote on the proposal, as to whether to be part of this majority or not. The fact that more people disapprove of something than approve of it doesn't seem to give me any reason, any more reason, to join that side than the other side. And it just doesn't seem to be, it's not that it's not a neutral reason, it's that it's not a reason at all.
I mean, you could say it's not a reason at all, are you saying that that a legislator could not coherently count that as a reason? Are you saying that's unintelligible? Or are you just saying it's a bad reason? I agree it's a bad reason. It's a bad non-neutral reason, or it's a non-neutral reason that's not a good reason. Or
I'm certainly saying that the sky is blue is a reason that just doesn't count.
Yeah.
It's not admissible to the discussion, it's not relevant.
But you don't think that the fact, okay, but that, at least the U.S. Supreme Court has identified majority disapproval as a reason.
Well,
they've said it's a good reason.
Okay,
but all I'm saying is that, right, that's a reason that has actually been given. It's a reason that I think we want to say the principle of neutrality excludes. Whether you think it's as bad as the sky is blue is another question, okay? It hasn't been taken to be that bad. Okay, it's at least taken to be relevant. So I say that's a reason that the principle of neutrality has been thought excluded, and that it's been an important part of its content to exclude.
So I'm going to let this this discussion go on a little bit and ask the other hand raisers to wait for a sec. So Jacob Levy wanted to jump in on this, as did Alan, and I'll ask you to be brief on.
I don't think you've yet escaped from either circularity or potentially non-intelligibility. In the rational basis standard that Scalia's minority opinion, not the Supreme Court, but Scalia's minority opinion thought that the statute in Lawrence met was, does this restriction of liberty have a rational relationship to a legitimate state interest? So what's being offered as the standard to the legislator who wishes to do his or her constitutional duty is things will count as legitimate state interests if they are what the majority wants. Well, presumably there is no law that is being passed in the face of bitter majority opposition. That is to say, what you're offering the legislators as a constitutional standard is no standard at all that constrains any law that could actually pass. This especially by speaking to the only evidence that the majority disapproves is the fact that the legislator...
Yeah, but it's not logically impossible. The legislature could easily pass a law that the majority disapproves of. There's no inconsistency there.
No, but the only evidence being offered of majority disapproval is the fact that an elected legislature banned it.
Fine, that's the evidence.
So consider three different cases. One, the state officials deliberate and decide that certain kind of sexual activity is shameful and they prohibit it. A second case, the state says, we're going to let the archbishop decide what is shameful and what's not, and we'll enforce that. And then in the third case, they say, we're going to let the majority decide what's shameful and what's not, and we'll enforce that. So you want to say that case one and case three are relevantly unalike, right? But case two and case three seem to me to have the same structure. In both situations, the state is kind of contracting out the formation of the judgment about what is shameful and what is not, and it's agreeing to just enforce whatever that outsourced contractor decides. But I don't find that case one and case two seem relevantly different enough to me. In other words, I don't think that the mere fact the state has outsourced the formation of the judgment is relevant for determining whether or not the state is enforcing a particular judgment about the good life. It doesn't seem to be tracking something that's sort of morally important, whether the state forms that judgment in-house or whether it says, we'll just put our course of power in the service of the judgment that this other agency forms.
Maybe it would help. Are you saying that it seems the fact that the majority disapproves of a form of conduct is a reason for the government to prohibit that conduct that the principle of neutrality, as you understand it, permits?
No, I think I'm saying the opposite.
You're saying that the principle of neutrality does not permit that reason.
If the principle of neutrality does not permit the state to form and enforce the judgment itself that homosexuality is shameful, then if it doesn't permit that, then it also doesn't permit the state to outsource the deliberation about what's shameful and what's not, and then enforce whatever it's told by that outside authority.
I missed something. Are you disagreeing with me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I missed the point of disagreement.
You say on page 7 that, so one possible thing that links the different items on the list is that they all involve the idea, they all involve a judgment that someone's conception of the good life
So let me go to that, and now I see what you're saying. All I'm saying is that if the government gives as its reason for prohibiting homosexual sodomy that the majority disapproves, it has not made any statement that logically entails that some conception of the good is false. That's all I was claiming there. I believe that that is a true statement, and I do not think you persuade me that it's false. There's no logical entailment there.
At any rate, you won't persuade him of it now. Colin.
Colin, I have a question from Peter, but I'll actually ask some questions from Jacob.
Turn your mic on.
So it's not entirely clear to me that the kind of inculcation of virtues
that might be thought to be necessary to sustain a liberal state are the sorts of fall within the area that constitutes an objectionable form of perfectionism. Right? That, you know, that we ought to be respectful of considerations of justice and basic rights and support the institutions that realize that. That doesn't seem like the kind of perfectionism that worry people traditionally about the state inculcating a particular religious view or advocating against certain views of sexual morality. But so that's just sort of a comment. My question is actually sort of has a sort of perhaps slightly heretical premise, right? Namely that your analysis works roughly like this, right? It says, well, you know, liberal institutions have sustained themselves without this perfectionism. Right? Perhaps the premise is false, namely that we haven't had genuine liberal institutions. Right? Now, if that is of the sort that is that Rawlsians and so on aspire to, you know, we haven't got the priority of liberty, the fair equality of opportunity, liberty at fair value, the difference principle, you know, none of these things are even closely approximated in the so-called liberal state. So one might reconfigure the Macedo-type argument and say, look, if we are going to have any chance of realizing, not sustaining, but realizing genuine liberal states, we're going to have to inculcate in citizens to somehow a genuine commitment to justice as the first virtue of social institutions. We don't have that. We have a politics in most democratic communities that does not prioritize the discourse of justice, it prioritizes the discourse of interests, and doesn't assure all the basic conditions that most Rawlsians take as uncontroversial conditions of justice. We don't have liberal states in the Rawlsian sense. So the fact that some versions of states have sustained themselves isn't really an argument against the kind of virtue inculcation. Now that doesn't mean that the virtue inculcation will be efficacious. It might not be, but
I'll make an entirely unoriginal response to the comment first. One of the oldest examples of the kind of virtue that people think citizens need in a pluralistic liberal society is the virtue that is associated with not believing that one's fellow citizens are damned. And that runs headlong into the neutrality thesis, because if the state relies for its existence as a pluralistic, tolerant society on citizens individually refusing to believe that their fellow citizens are damned, then the state needs a certain shape of religious belief to the exclusion of all kinds of other shapes of religious belief on the part of the citizens, as it were, in their church life, in their private religious dispositions. The claim is that you cannot directly inculcate, because it is not the name of a character disposition, respect for religious freedom of others. You have to inculcate something like tolerance. This is all in quotes, this is all stuff from other people, but it's why I don't think that dodge is available to me. I do think that even the core sense of what character dispositions people have thought liberal states relied on do run into precisely the same traditional concerns that the neutrality thesis was concerned with all along. For the second, it seems to me that if you want to say that, then you are stuck with saying, as we say in my home state of New Hampshire, you can't get there from here. I mean, if it turns out that no society that we have seen is relevantly liberal, and where liberal is a threshold concept and the threshold is really, really high, rather than liberal being a direction such that we can say a whole lot of societies are very much more liberal than most societies have been through human history, and it's interesting and informative to look at that fact. If it is a very high threshold concept, and the perfectionists or the non-neutralists are right, that you can't really get the institutions until you have citizens who are really dedicated all the time toward achieving the institutions, then it seems to me we're forced to ask, well, what institution is going to make those citizens? The Rawlsian model works on a self-contained basis. That is, if you bring the whole thing into existence all at once, but it does not work on any kind of evolutionary basis. There's no story you can tell whereby the institutions that are chosen by citizens who are these corrupt, interested, non-justice-oriented persons would be the kinds of institutions that would suddenly start creating the kinds of people who would aim at better institutions in the future. I think that there is a relevant sense in which liberalism is a direction and not only or merely a threshold concept, and that you can point to changes over time and say, well, across a variety of dimensions and a variety of societies, things have become more liberal. That is not the only direction of human history, but that is a direction of some of human history. And they seem to have been able to become more liberal without violating the bootstrap paradox. They seem to have been able to get there when they were coming out of something that was worse than what they had been.
Harash, you have both you're both the last questioner, and you have asked for a...
It's the same one, though, so it's actually
okay.
Really quick. So this is a question for Jacob on this point, actually, it follows up. And I want to ask the question with reference to a concrete case, that of Turkey. But the problem with it is that it raises three issues, and I wanted to only raise two, so I just ask you to abstract away from it. So the issue that it raises is the difference between the founding and sustaining over time. That's one. The other issue that it raises is the difference between liberalism and democracy. And then the other issue it raises, which I don't want to, is the difference between Macedo-type liberalism and Ataturk and the general type liberalism, which is a lot more coercive and a lot more, right? So just abstracting away from the particular kinds of policies that the generals in Turkey and the court feels that it needs to defend. So the one issue is, it might turn out, and this is really directed to your argument about the fact that liberal societies have navels, right? This idea that, you know, well, it's the chicken and egg problem that you appeal to challenge the unsustainability thesis. So if we're willing to make a distinction between, as I think we should, the conditions that are required to found a particular kind of state and the conditions that may be required to sustain them over time, so that you can imagine that one might think that the kinds of actions that Ataturk needed to take may, right, be different than the kinds of things that the Turkish state now may need to undertake, right, because of the difference between founding and, you know, a radical change in the political regime and what's empirically required to sustain it. And we also now take into account that we're not just talking, in the case of the Macedo kind of argument, about liberal states, but we're talking about liberal democratic states, in the sense of thinking that there has to be some kind, right, the requirement of political participation rights, and not simply the respect for other kinds of liberties. In that case, that seems to be the kind of thing that Turkey, right, is now confronting, which is to say that if you're not simply concerned with, so you're concerned not with founding, but sustaining over time, and you're concerned not just with defending liberalism in the narrow sense, but also you are now attempting to democratize in some way where the populace is mobilized. At that point, do you feel that my sense is that the appeal to the chicken and egg problem doesn't really get at the sustainability issue, because the argument might be that the liberal virtues are required not for founding the state, which is how you framed it, and not just to sustain liberal institutions, but to sustain liberal institutions over time in the face of democratic mobilization. So to frame it in that.
I'm not sure whether I'm taking the question in the direction that you meant it, and challenge me if I'm not. I find it hard to think about the Turkish case without moving further in the direction that I was already in. That is to say, while Ataturk and the founding intended to enact something like some at least distant cousin of a liberal perfectionist state that would make new citizens who were appropriate for the institutions that they were creating, it has in fact always failed to be that. The Turkish citizenry has never been that which Ataturk intended for them to be. And as Turkey, in the moments when Turkey is open to democratic participation, that fact is made plain. And yet, it is not the case that the citizens who have always resisted the secularizing perfectionism on the part of the state have been the citizens who have threatened democracy. The threat to democracy has always come from the other direction. It has always come from those elements of the regime that said, well, it is intolerable that the order would seem to throw up leaders who failed to live up to our secular perfectionist ideals, and therefore we will cut the democratic processes short. Turkey seems to me to be a striking case in which, in fits and starts, and not perfectly, but surprisingly robustly over the course of some 80 years, roughly democratic and at least sometimes liberal institutions have survived with the support of a citizenry that was not the citizenry that the perfectionist state sought to remake them as. It didn't need to remake them, and when it sought to remake them, it became the agent of restrictions of liberalism and democracy alike.
We should probably stop for lunch. So I'd like to thank our speakers.